Hello and welcome to the St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles podcast. Each episode will bring you the latest news from the St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles, as well as fascinating interviews with entertainment personalities, government leaders, and community advocates. St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles, where Scotland meets the City of Angels. Let's get started. Welcome to another great episode of the St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles podcast. I'm your host, Joanna, and today we have an amazing show lined up for you. I'm incredibly excited about this. First, I'd love to introduce you to our co-host and guest moderator, attorney Sean Lettingham, who is also a member of the St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles.
Thank you, Joanna.
And today we have two amazing guests, and it's two for the price of one, which has got me really excited. First, I would like to introduce you to Gordon Noble and Nicholas Evans. They're both archaeologists and a historian who have written an amazing book about the original Scots, the Picts. It's entitled The King in the North, and they're both here today to talk about their book and some history. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much for asking us to come. Thank you.
So let's get started. And for people who don't know, and I am, unfortunately, I fall into this category myself, generally speaking, who were the Picts and what role did they play in Scottish history?
Yeah, well, the Picts were the inhabitants of much of Scotland, all of the area north of the Firth of Forth, except for Argyll and parts of the Hebrides in the west of Scotland. They are first mentioned by the Romans in the late 3rd century AD, and they stop appearing in sources in the early 10th century AD. They're important as the predecessors and sort of ancestors of many of the inhabitants of Scotland. They attacked the Romans in the late Roman period in the 4th and early 5th centuries. And they're also significant because they stopped the English Northumbrians' advance into Scotland in the early medieval period, in the 7th century, where they halted their expansion into northern Britain. The Picts themselves also developed into a single kingdom, which formed the core of its successor called the Kingdom of Alba, which was the Kingdom of the Scots. So it's important in terms of the development of Scotland. But the Picts were also important for other reasons in terms of shaping the landscape and many other aspects of Scotland. So, for instance, it was during their time that Christianity was introduced into Scotland, and places like St. Andrews and the cult of St. Andrew were established in the Pictish period. As well as that, lots of the other parts of the Scottish landscape, and places like Perth, Aberdeen, Dundee, probably, were also they also have names that are Pictish. And so there's quite a lot of continuity from the Pictish period later. So a lot of the roots of Scotland are in Pictish era. So yeah, I mean, Gordon can maybe talk more about the archaeology on some of this. So
yeah, it's such a formative period, as Nick says, in terms of, you know, setting the scene for the development of the kingdoms of Alba and later Scotland. So really, the Pictish kingdoms are the first ones we have on record in this part of the world. And as Nick says, creates really the foundations and the backbone for those later kingdoms to develop and flourish. In terms of the archaeology, we've got some really real iconic monuments and features of the Picts. There are symbol stones or symbol tradition. This is almost a system like the Egyptian hieroglyphs almost, but on a kind of much smaller scale, which seems to be some form of expression to do with identity. We haven't really cracked the code behind that, but it's one of the elements that contribute to the enigma, the mystery of the Picts. And part of that mystery has also really been the lack of archaeological sites from this time period. We have a few forts, but very few settlements, really. So that's what our project has been all about, really, is trying to uncover more sites from the Pictish period and trying to understand more about the Pictish background and backdrop to Scotland.
And I certainly would love to hear more about the forts and the symbol stones. But taking a step back, your recent book, The King in the North, focuses on two Pictish kingdoms in particular, Fortru and Kay. Would love to hear what your research has found as far as the importance of, as I understand it, Fortru in particular, as potentially an over kingdom of the Picts.
Yeah, maybe Nick can start on some of the historical background, then I can flesh out what we've been doing on our project and what's in the book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're right. Fortru is the most important kingdom of the Picts. It's Kay is one where we have evidence for it as a region, but we don't know so much as compared to Fortru. Fortru is the name of a kingdom that seems to have been based around the Murray Firth, around Inverness, a bit to the north and to the east, to places like Burghead that we have been investigating. But in the late 7th century, they were the kingdom that defeated the English at the Battle of Nechtensmere in 685 and expanded southwards to conquer the rest of the Pictish areas and to create this over kingdom, as you say. So they are sort of key to the formation of this kingdom. They probably had some ancestry quite a few centuries before in the Roman period, because we get a reference from the late 4th century to a tribe who attacked the Romans in the late 4th century called the Verturiones, and that's the same root word as Fortru. So they have clearly been around for a long time, but it's in the 7th century that they rise, become this key area. Kay is another area that's mentioned in as a plain in texts, and also as the Bane, the hill or mountain of Kay, which is likely to be the hill fort of Benachi in the northwest, to the northwest of Aberdeen. So, I mean, Gordon's investigated this site and can tell us a lot more about it and some of the other interesting things about Fortru as well.
Yeah, so I mean, our project, original project, Northern Picts, started about 10 years ago, and it was really developing from that historical watershed moment when Alex Wolfe noted that the Kingdom of Fortru, rather than being in southern Pictland and kind of central Scotland, as it was traditionally assumed, was actually in the north, the kings in the north, as the title of our book. So it really created a new perspective on the Pictish period, that these northern territories were much more important than we had assumed before. And that made a lot of the sense of the archaeology. So, for example, a lot of the Pictish symbol stones are actually concentrated in northern areas, and there's a whole series of significant forts as well that have been largely uninvestigated. So over the last 10 years, that's what we've been trying to do, is trying to identify the main centres of power of these northern kingdoms, Fortru in particular, and also Kay as well. Try and understand more about these symbol stones, the context that they turn up in, and really just trying to put some dots on the map in terms of actually finding sites and understanding their development through time. So as I said earlier, you know, it's always been a real struggle to actually find the archaeology of the Picts, which has led to contributed to that mysterious notion. So that has been our big challenge. We've been going around the landscape, sampling lots of sites, lots of failures as well as successes. But hopefully, once you read the book, you'll understand just how much new information we've been able to find about Pictish sites, and really helping flesh out the very limited historical sources we have, and growing that archaeological record to understand the development of those northern Pictish kingdoms through time.
And one of the excavations that you detail in the book is what you describe as a royal settlement near Rhynie. Would love to hear a little bit more about what you found there, both in terms of the settlement itself, as well as some of the unique imported goods and the goods used for the manufacture of metals and precious jewelry and things like that.
Sure. Well, again, this started about 10 years ago, and we went to this tiny village today called the village of Rhynie, which is just about 40 minutes drive west of Aberdeen in northeast Scotland. And it was when, in the first few years, when we were setting up the new Department of Archaeology at Aberdeen, and this is an area we decided to focus on for fieldwork and get our students out there and the like. Little did we know what we were going to find, really. It'd been known for many decades as a particular concentration of Pictish stones. So these stones have these abstract symbols, they've got animal symbols on them, usually in pairs. And there's eight of these stones known from the village of Rhynie. You know, normally most sites you might find one or two, a small handful if you're lucky. So there was these eight stones from Rhynie. And there was one in particular was found in 1978. He was ploughed up by the farmer called the Rhynie Man. And he's this carving of an individual. He's got these big pointy teeth, very exaggerated features, and he carries this axe over his shoulder. And we were fascinated by that monument and wanted to know more about it. And it came from a place in the landscape just to the south of the modern village of Rhynie. And aerial photography in the same year showed these series of enclosures on this little hill from where the stone came from. So we put that together with the stones. And also the place name is really interesting. So the place name has the element re, which means king. So we had some suggestions that this could have been, you know, a high status site. But again, we didn't really fathom what we might find there. So basically we started digging in 2011 on these enclosures that you could identify from there, which basically was a buried settlement underneath the ground. And we found that it was an enclosed settlement. So it had ditches and banks, a big wooden wall, and inside were these rectangular buildings. And we found very quickly that this was indeed an elite settlement, you know, the highest status of sites, really. And the reason we know that is because it had incredibly unusual material for the time period. So it dates to the late 4th century, 5th century and 6th century. So in that very late Roman Iron Age into the early medieval period. And they were importing wine from the Eastern Mediterranean, which is something you only find on royal sites elsewhere or elite sites, certainly. They were importing drinking vessels, glass drinking vessels from France, drinking vessels from Anglo-Saxon England. They had, you know, the latest state-of-the-art feasting and drinking equipment. And they were producing lots of material themselves. There was lots of stone molds for making ingots, which is a kind of raw bar of metal that you trade with. They were making fancy brooches, pins, all the kind of elite dress accessories that you, for example, in Anglo-Saxon England, you would find in high status graves, but we don't have that tradition in Pictland, unfortunately. But we could see that this was a major center of production. It was an elite settlement. And then just over the last few years, we've begun to look at the wider landscape. So just down right by the modern village, in fact, underneath the modern village, there's a contemporary cemetery with what would have been barrow monuments with individuals buried underneath, again, dating to the 5th, 6th centuries. And then there's two other forts in the wider landscape. There's one called Tapenoth, which is really dominant in the landscape. And that was always assumed to be much earlier in date, Iron Age or even Bronze Age in date. But we just got dates back in 2019 to show that that's actually 5th and 6th century AD in date as well, so Pictish. And that is the second biggest hill fort in Scotland and it encloses something like 800 house platforms. So it suggests there was a big population there. You know, whether it was a permanent population or people were gathering at certain times of the year is hard to tell. And that's what we hope to do in the next few years is try and address some of those questions. And then there's another fort at Caer Moor, which is much more modest in size, but it was using hundreds of trees, timbers to create the ramparts of the fort and buildings inside. So, you know, to go from an area of archaeology where you maybe had, you know, one or two settlements known to uncovering this really high status settlement, tapping off with hundreds of houses inside. You can see the kind of, you know, massive data input we've had over the last few years in terms of understanding more about the Picts. And going from a situation where you could say, well, Picts might have been doing this because this is what they're doing in contemporary Ireland, where they have very good records, or this is what they were doing in Anglo-Saxon England because we have, you know, hundreds of settlements dug there. It's actually saying, well, you know, we've got this amazing picture site. It's got these all these sculptural elements, which gives you an insight into, you know, things potentially like, you know, pagan religion, cosmologies of the pre-Christian world. So it's just a real eye-opener in terms of what we found at that site. So it's been a real key site for us, and all outlined in the book.
There's another site that I want to get to a little bit later that you also discovered at Dunacair. But before we get there, you'd mentioned the interplay, or at least the sort of the contemporary kingdoms of Ireland at the same time. And I know that what part of your project is looking at the relationship between the two and then comparing and contrasting. As far as the Picts go, as a sort of more casual historian, one of my favorite stories of the Picts comes from Bede, where he explains that when the Picts arrived in Scotland from wherever they came from, that they didn't bring enough women with them for a functioning society. So they went to the Irish for wives, and the Irish said, you can marry some of our women on the condition that the royal succession will go through the mother's side, matrilineal succession. So that way, they, you know, there will always be some Irish as a king of the Picts. And I know that Dr. Evans, you wrote a little bit about this in the book, as well as a paper you did about 10 years ago as well. But would love to get some insights into how royal succession worked amongst the Picts, or at least what we know and what we suspect.
All right. Yeah. Well, I mean, first thing is that that is a really interesting series of tales that explain the origins of the Picts and their settlement. And I think it's found in various forms, firstly in Bede and then in later Irish tales. So Bede, in this early version written about 731 AD, says that their Picts went to Ireland and got the wives on condition that when the succession was in doubt, that succession would be through the female line. So, and then later, the Irish texts are a bit more sort of forthright in saying that its succession is always through the female line. So there's a bit of difference there in the texts that are actually from when the Picts were in existence. So generally, people have used that to argue that the Picts were matrilineal in their succession practices, that as king's sister's son would usually succeed to the throne rather than the son to his father. But other scholars in the last 30 years have argued that the overall concept may actually explain a particular sort of instance and case from around about 700 AD when the Picts had a disputed succession and it went through the female line. So it's to do with that circumstance, and they tried to project it back, as most of the societies did at that time, that they would explain the present by using the past to create precedents and to justify what's happening. So the argument is that this is one of those instances which happened around about 700 AD. But I think, I mean, it's an interesting story, and I think whatever happens, it's really interesting that it has this Irish element, because we get quite a bit of evidence for Irish influence in Pictland through Christianity and also in general society. And clearly the Picts were willing to admit that they could have Irish ancestry, and that this was something to be pleased about rather than something to regard as something to be denied or to not believe could take place. So that's really quite interesting that they could be regarded as partners of the Picts. But people are generally skeptical about whether there's matrilineal at the moment. What I tried to do in my paper of 2008 was to look at the other evidence for succession from king lists and chronicles to see what they tell us. If we put aside the tales for a minute and then looked at this evidence, what would you find? And so what we found was quite an interesting, unusual picture that sons don't succeed their fathers to succession. And there's also an interesting naming pattern. Often in early medieval societies, names had significance. They had meaning not only from what they actually meant in the language, but also you could have royal names, particularly family names. And what you get with the Picts is that the names of the kings were repeated. They were names like Brithe, Gartnate, Talagan, Neftan. These are sort of royal names. And then their fathers, though, don't have the same names. They have different names, which seem to be other names. We don't know much about them, but they don't appear as the names of the kings. So my argument was that there is an attempt on the part of the Pictish kingdom in Fortiu to try to avoid father-to-son succession. And the name pattern may actually be part of that, that you, right from an early age, from birth or childhood, you have people who have royal names and people who, in the royal dynasty, who don't have royal names. And what, so only the ones with royal names could become king. So this is sort of practices that you see in terms of the names of the kings and lack of father-son succession until about the middle of the 8th century. So until then, you seem to get what people clearly in the elite didn't want the succession to be dominated by a small kindred. They wanted it to be wider, sort of larger pool, perhaps of people in different regions of the Picts, or just a wider dynasty. Whether that they did it by matrilineage, that's, I couldn't disprove or prove. The evidence doesn't work to help us. It could be that there were different sort of alternation patterns or something like that. Generally, though, what we found was that you get quite a lot of kings being deposed. So clearly, it wasn't necessarily a friendly way in which everyone came to an agreement and decided that they would share the kingship. It had to be imposed on them by other people in the elite. But what you get in the 8th century is that, as with many systems of succession, it changes. You get one king, a king called Anwist, son of Wiergwist, or Angus, son of Fergus in Gaelic sources, who takes the kingship. And what he does is he dominates and kills a lot of these other people who are around him. Basically, any rivals are killed. And it seems like he tries to change the succession so his sons and descendants can become kings more quickly. And so from his time, what you get is the name patterns. There are no royal, no division between royal names and non-royal names. They're all royal names. And you get father-son succession happening after a break.
As I understand it, at least, the settlement that you found at Dunacair is known as now to be the oldest known Pictish fort. Correct me if I've got that wrong, but if I have it right, you know, take the glory. But can you tell us what that excavation has taught us about the symbols, the symbols that Picts used?
So again, this came about from us trying to work out the context of a group of stones. So at Dunacair, there is the sea stack today. It's just a tiny sea stack. But in the 19th century, six Pictish stones were found on the stack by a bunch of youths from the nearby village. You know, and in days before television, they decided to go up on top of the stack and dig around, hoping to find treasure. But they didn't find any treasure, but they found these stones and they threw them into the sea, being, you know, youths of the day. And it was only in the years and decades later that people recovered the stones and said, well, look, these are really interesting, these are important, these are Pictish stones. But they're a bit unusual stones, you know, they're much more kind of rough and ready compared to some of the, you know, incredibly beautiful and arresting designs you'll see at places like Rhynie. So they've always been seen as, you know, either they're early examples or they're, you know, kind of almost like graffiti, later on. So anyway, we were trying to puzzle, you know, why are these stones coming from the strange, you know, lump of rock in the North Sea? And very few people have been up there since the 19th century, because it's quite dangerous to get up there. But we hired a professional climber and he helped us get up on top. And we dug some test pits just to see what was there. Not really expecting to find much again, but we found another settlement. And we found evidence for a rampart, so a big stone wall going around the edge of it. So essentially what it is it's incredibly eroded by coastal erosion action, the waves, and like a fort, you know, another high status settlement of the Picts. But again, it's very early, as you say, so it's 3rd, 4th century AD in date, or maybe even 2nd to 4th century AD in date. And so it's very early example. You know, you get hill forts in the Iron Age, so, you know, BC centuries generally. There's very few during the Roman Iron Age when, you know, the Romans are occupying parts of Scotland and having influence further north. There's very few of these forts, but Dunacre is one of them. And it seems to have a lot of the characteristics you see at picture sites later on, you know, in terms of having symbol stones, the ramparts, structures inside. And again, they're kind of importing materials. So there's unusual Roman glass vessels, there's bits of Roman pottery finding their way to this site, which would have been, you know, hundreds of miles north of the frontier at this point. So they're tapping into these networks. And it looks like if you read the account of where the stones were found, they were found on the rampart, essentially. And that's where they were thrown into the sea. And we were able to date the rampart, we were able to date the settlement inside. Because at the moment, we don't have any techniques for dating the stones themselves. So that's always been the problem with these stones, you know. So it's been based on art historical analysis. You know, this looks a little bit like this metalwork vessel over here. It looks a little bit like some of the manuscript art. So generally people have thought, you know, symbol stones were maybe 5th century, 6th century, 7th century even in date. And only a few people have suggested they could be as early as, you know, 3rd, 4th century. But it looks fairly convincing that they come from that rampart and they come from the settlements. We've got nothing later in the 4th century from what's left of the settlement. So really it suggests that these stones are, and this tradition is being developed in that late Roman period. And it kind of makes a lot of sense, you know, in terms of, you know, contact with a literate culture to the south. And similar things are happening in Ireland and Scandinavia at the same time, you know, beyond the frontier again. These people are developing things like Ulm in Ireland, and runes in Scandinavia, using, in those cases, you know, the Latin alphabet, but developing their own system. And likewise, the Picts seem to be developing their own system as well, but using, you know, a non-Latin way of doing it, so very individual way. And we still don't really know what these symbols mean. But if you look at some of the later stones, you can see that they seem to be labeling people. So either their names or a rank or some sort of something to do with their identity, basically. And the classic thing that, you know, Ulm and runes are used for representing names, sometimes lineages. So it seems likely, that seems the most likely interpretation, is that they're actually representing Pictish names. But we don't have a Rosetta Stone to kind of crack that and say exactly what those messages are.
Well, I think you've touched on something. One of the things that I think is most interesting about the Picts, and I don't think I'm alone, is the mystery. There are just so many things we don't know about the Picts because they left so few written records. And as far as, you know, the records they left in the form of monuments and symbol stones, we haven't yet been able to you know, crack the code, as you will. One follow-up question, I didn't want to sidetrack, but I was just curious. Was Dunacre always a sea stack, or do we think that it had been connected to the mainland and then later eroded away?
I think it would have been certainly more connected than it is now. And I think we're dealing with a site that's just a tiny percentage of what was there. So it's, you know, a very active sea, the North Sea. And it's a type of rock which has all these veins of soft sandstone. So once they're eroded, whole chunks just fall out. So yeah, I think even the 19th century, it looks like the stack was a bit bigger than it is today. So probably, you know, another few generations and the whole thing might be gone, really. But we've excavated as much as we could, really. It's quite a sight.
Yeah. You can see it from the train line on the coast, and it's close to the Castle of Donata, which is also a Pictish site. So there's quite a lot going on there, but it's great to people to be able to excavate it while it still exists, at least in partial form. But yeah, there's a video, isn't there, that you've got, a Vimeo video that has a sort of reconstruction of what it looks like.
Yeah, it's you'll be able to see it on our Facebook page, but National Geographic run with it as well. I think it's been viewed by a million people now.
I did watch one video showing, you know, the climber setting up the tot line and then, you know, going, you know, with the carabiners and going hand over hand to get up there. It was quite a, you know, when folks think of archaeology and think of sort of the Indiana Jones adventure, this one really seemed to fit that mold.
It did. And I'm terrified of heights, so I'm not sure what to do again. Oh, wow. A very, very, very photogenic site. So it was an amazing place to work.
What are some of the difficulties do you face as an archaeologist and a historian in trying to make sense of your findings without much in the form of written records behind you?
Yeah, well, on the textual side, yes, there's not a huge amount of material to be working from. So a lot of what we do is trying to understand how to interpret them, how much reliance we can place on any particular piece of evidence, particularly if it's written later in surviving in later documents. So that is a real tricky puzzle that, I mean, you get used to when you do any medieval history, but it really is tricky when it comes to the Picts. And one of the difficulties is because the texts that we do have generally are by people from outside Pictland. They're by the Gaels in the west, from Northumbria and among the Anglo-Saxons, or from Ireland. They're later. They survive in later manuscripts and therefore might be representing something, some concepts that are later, some different ideas about the past and how they wanted to regard their own past. So you have to really sort of think about all these different contexts and then find that one nugget that might actually be useful. But that's really, I mean, I find that really fascinating and enjoyable to do that. And that's what really draws me to the Picts and the early medieval period in general. And I think there are some really intriguing things that we can do in terms of the later evidence with, say, things like place names that you can sort of work backwards. And that's a lot of what we're doing in our current project. And also things like different territorial names, trying to understand how things, the society and the landscape and how people lived in the communities, how that changes over time, and therefore try and get back. So there's a lot of different approaches you can take. So I think that's one of the things you have to do, is to try and not think in terms of just single disciplines, but try and think in terms of lots of different types of evidence. So, I mean, it's great that you've got the textual evidence, but you don't really understand it without the archaeological evidence. And the really big gap is that we don't, with the textual evidence, get any really good idea about what people thought at a local level, how they lived their lives. And we really are dependent on the archaeology for a lot of that, even if that has issues of interpretation too. But it's when you can marry the different evidence, then that's how it works. So I think Gordon could tell you more about the archaeological side.
Yeah, I mean, my background is in prehistoric archaeology, so working with no texts whatsoever. But I actually came back to doing Pictish archaeology, and it was what actually originally set me off in terms of a passion for looking at the past. So to actually have any sort of historical records is fantastic in terms of actually saying, well, we know forts are used in this way, let's go dig one and what do you find and how can those things be compared? But it is fantastic to get all those disciplines working together, which is what our current Leverhulme funded project is all about, is working with Nick and working with environmental archaeologists and working with place name specialists and combining all those different elements in order to try and understand some of these sites more. And really, it's just been great to begin to populate the archaeological record in a much greater sense than before. So I think before I started to do prehistoric archaeology, I thought about doing work on the Picts, but it almost seemed pointless. You know, what could you say with, you know, a handful of settlements and all these enigmatic stones that nobody had ever looked at from an archaeological perspective? You know, what? Why bother? But now, you know, if it just shows you, you know, you excavate one site like Rhynie and you can just have an entirely new perspective on the Picts and their international connections. You can excavate somewhere like Dunacair and begin to pin down the chronology of things like the symbol stones in much greater detail. So that's been great, but we are still light years behind, you know, other places. If you look at contemporary Ireland, for example, they have something like 40 to 60,000 early medieval settlements known, ring forts, settlements turning up all the time through developer-funded archaeology. They have a much richer historical record. If you look at Anglo-Saxon England as well, they have, you know, in one cemetery, they might have hundreds or thousands of burials. And we probably have maybe, I don't know, 50 or 60 excavated Pictish graves with skeletal material, if we're lucky. So we're still, you know, a long way to go before we're making our archaeology on par with other regions. But, you know, you've got to start somewhere. So that's what our project has been all about and will continue to be about.
What happened to the Picts, actually?
Well, try, I'll answer this, Gunn. Yeah, well, it's not an easy question to answer, and people have really debated it. Ideas have changed a lot in the last few decades. But what seems to be becoming clear is that they didn't just disappear. In later folklore, generally, people thought that they were the wee dark folk who moved into living in the ground and could be found when people were in moorland and various other places or in old sites, but in reality they didn't hide away. We know that also they weren't completely destroyed, as the medieval sources said. The medieval sources said that they were destroyed by Kenneth MacAlpine, the king from who's supposed to have come from the west, from Dal Riada, Argyll, and invited the nobles to a feast and then massacred them, sort of like Game of Thrones style, really. And that then ended the Picts. But actually, in contemporary sources, he's called a king of the Picts, and you get Picts being named for a generation afterwards. It's around 900 AD that you start to get a change. The king of the Picts then stops being used, and it's king of Alba. Pictish terminology stops being used, like fortune stops being used, and you get Gaelic terminology. You get Alba for the kingdom. You get people being called Scotty or Gaels. And so there's a transition there, but it doesn't seem to have been one which we can see is marked by any massive transformation in the kingdom. The kingdom of Alba is basically the Pictish kingdom, just as with a new name. So what we think is that there's been a gradual change over centuries with Gaelic culture from the west, gradually expanding, maybe from the 7th, 8th centuries onwards. And that's partly through the church, but also I think there's wider evidence for influence, like from Ogham inscriptions and from texts and from things like the origin legend, that shows that there was a willingness to admit Gaels into the kingdom, that they could be Pictish. There wasn't necessarily a problem with people being speaking a different language from the Picts and then being Pictish. But it seems like there's a tipping point around the late 9th century, early 10th century, and that's probably something to do with the Vikings, who at that period, having raided for quite a few decades, suddenly in the 860s and 870s have massive campaigns like they have in England, and they occupy Pict land, they kill Pictish king, they ask for tribute, and they presumably put a lot of stress on the kingdom. And in that context, we think it's quite probable that somehow the Gaelic nobility is perhaps preferred. Then I don't know how much migration there would be, but there may have been a bit. But generally, it's thought that there's a sort of transition and a sort of rebranding of the kingdom. They survive the Vikings, and they decide that they will be something slightly different. They adopt the term Alba, which means Britain, and it seems to be a term that's used to make people, whatever their background, incorporated in this kingdom as this sort of shared identity that they can all have. And then gradually you get Gaelic culture expanding and spreading even further. So the Picts become a sort of memory rather than being something that is sort of living. But it doesn't mean they disappeared. They're all still there. And some of the institutions, like places like St. Andrews and church institutions and a lot of the local society institutions, probably just continued from the Pictish period, but gradually over time change into a more Gaelic and then English and Scots form. So they didn't go, but the identity changed, and then gradually the language must have died out as well.
Well, in that way, it feels a lot like some of the later occurrences we see in history, you know, with the Normanization of the Gaelic areas, and then, you know, and Scots being replaced by my more traditional, you know, more Southern English as well. And so, you know, rather than a people disappearing, it's a people, people's culture sort of merging into another movement.
You know, the fact that the language died out would have made people try and seek an explanation for why did that happen. Well, the obvious explanation is that all those people were massacred and they were killed. And that leads to, you know, the kind of Game of Thrones type mythology that emerges later on. But it's, you know, it's probably simply a language shift and as Nick says, a bit of a rebranding of the kingdom to probably be a bit more inclusive in terms of, you know, all the different identities that then became under the banner of the kingdom of Alba. So yeah, it's a fascinating period. In some ways, archaeologically, we know even less about the 9th to 11th centuries than we do about you know, the Pictish period. So
looking forward, what future projects do you anticipate in the next couple of years?
Well, we're still working on one, which is the Comparative Kingship Project, which is funded by the Leverhulme Trust. And that is trying to compare our work in Pictland with other contemporary kingdoms and societies. So it's looking at the Dáil Riada and the kingdom that kind of broached the Irish Sea, had territory in Northern Ireland and in Southwest Scotland, and also the kingdom of or area of Munster in Southern Ireland. And looking at how these different areas, these different kingdoms, these different polities developed through time, and using that kind of multidisciplinary approach, as Nick was outlining earlier on. So we have people working on an environmental record of that time period, looking at power centers, looking at all the charters and historical documents that we have, where they exist, and just trying to have a more cohesive view of how some of these kingdoms actually emerge and develop through time. So we've got a couple more years of that project to go. And yeah, who knows what else might come out. We'll write some more books, hopefully.
Well, I certainly want to thank you for your time, Juwan. I don't know if you have any other questions, but this has been truly fascinating. It's I thank you for giving me the excuse and opportunity to read the book. It certainly opened up my eyes into a lot of things, as far as separating the fact and the fiction, and that murky area in between where we just don't quite know yet.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's and if anyone wants to buy the book, there's all the royalties are going to the Talbot Discovery Center at Port Mahomock, which is as a major Pictish monastery, and it goes towards supporting the local museum there, which shows some of the remains that have been found. So it's great for people to support something like that when they're purchasing it. So yeah,
it's a fantastic little Pictish museum. So if you're ever over in Scotland, you need to go visit and yeah, buy the book, I think.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Sean, thanks so much for being our guest moderator. It's always fun when we have a guest moderator who's really into the subject as well. It just makes it so much more enjoyable. I have learned so much today, and I can't wait to dive into this book. Like, I am so excited to read this book now. again, let everybody know the name of the book, where they can find it, and how they can get in touch with you guys if they have questions or anything like that, and keep up with what you guys have going on as far as future projects and whatnot.
Yeah, sure. So the book is called The King in the North, The Pictish Realms of Fortru and Kay, and it's published by Berlin. And yeah, Amazon is probably your best bet in the States for getting a hold of a copy. It's only about $20, I think. It's very low price. In terms of keeping up with us, we're both based at the University of Aberdeen in the Department of Archaeology, so check out our website. And we have a Facebook and a Twitter account, which is called Northern Picks. So keep up to date with all our work through there. So that's probably the best way to check us out and keep up to date with our progress.
Gordon's very good at posting on Facebook with all the exciting things that they're doing when they're excavating. And so it's actually a really rewarding place to go and find out what we're doing. So urge everyone to join that group if they can.
Again, thank you guys so much for taking the time out today. I know it's weird time. It's like, 5 o'clock out there. So I really appreciate you guys taking this evening to speak with us. Sean, do you want to have anything else you want to say?
No, other than sharing a thank you. I recognize that you guys have quite a busy schedule in addition to the excavations and your other university responsibilities. I know that you have quite a number of presentations like these that you give, but we really appreciate you sharing your time with those of us, you know, half a world away.
It's great to be asked to do this because it's fantastic to be able to tell people what we're doing and that people are so interested. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you both.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of the St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles podcast. For more information on the St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles, visit www.standrewsla.org. And don't forget to like our Facebook page, Instagram, and YouTube channels as well. Have a great week, and we'll see you next episode.